We'll turn again then, please, to Deuteronomy, and we're going to be considering that passage that we read, chapter 17, verse 14, to chapter 18, verse 22. Now, if you were to compare the whole authority structure that exists in modern British society with the authority structure that exists in modern Japanese society, for instance, you would find significant differences. The way local government works, the way national government works, the way the court system works, at all those levels, you would discover many points of divergence. But there's one authority figure, at least, that is common to both societies. Indeed, it's common to every society across the world and throughout history. I'm talking about the parent. The parent is the most basic human authority figure. And it's for that reason, then, that the fifth of the Ten Commandments focuses exclusively on parental authority. Honour your father and your mother. The commandment isn't cluttered with a whole load of other authority figures besides parents, which might have been relevant to ancient Israel, but wouldn't have had much relevance for modern Britain or for modern Japan. The Ten Commandments are timeless and universal in their significance, and it's a timeless and universal authority figure which the Fifth Commandment spotlights. But that's not to say, however, that other authority figures are unimportant. That's clearly not the case. In ancient Israel, there were judges, and there were kings, and there were priests, and there were prophets. And these authority figures weren't timeless and universal. To a greater or lesser degree, they were time-bound and culture-bound, and so they weren't included within the terms of the Fifth Commandment itself. But they mattered nonetheless, so much so indeed that here in the middle of Deuteronomy, as Moses explores the implications and applications of the commandments, he devotes two whole chapters to these other authority figures. For the Israelites, you see, and for us too, obedience to the Fifth Commandment ultimately meant not just submission to parents, but submission indeed to the whole authority structure that existed in their particular social context. And so last week then we considered judges and the whole judicial system. And this week we're going to be considering kings and priests and prophets. And even though these particular authority figures then aren't part of our social context, there are important principles here which I think we can profitably examine. So let's look at each in turn. And first of all this morning, kingship in Israel. Kingship in Israel. And this is chapter 17, verses 14 to 20. Now it needs to be said immediately that these verses are very limited in their scope. It certainly isn't a job description that we have here. The word which recurs quite frequently is the word not. Do not place a foreigner over you. The king must not acquire great numbers of horses. He must not take many wives. He must not accumulate large amounts of silver and gold. He must not consider himself better than his brothers. This is basically a list of pitfalls to be avoided. Potential abuses of monarchy, which in Israel must not be tolerated. And if we ask then, well, what are these abuses? What are these potential abuses of monarchy which in Israel must be avoided? Three answers present themselves. First of all, self-indulgence. That's the first potential abuse. When a king then indulges himself with superfluous assets, whether an excessive collection of horses, in verse 16, horses being the tanks and fighter jets of the ancient world, or an excessive number of wives, verse 17, or an excessive amount of cash, also verse 17. Now, among the nations, of course, it was simply expected and assumed that these were precisely the things that kings pursued. As one commentator puts it, weapons, women, and wealth, why else be a king? But in Israel, it was to be different. In Israel, self-indulgence was an abuse, and an inexcusable abuse of monarchy. Second abuse, self-determination. Self-determination. A king determining himself how he's going to rule, what policies he's going to implement, what agenda he's going to pursue. A king basically writing his own manifesto, imposing his own will upon the nation, arranging Israel's religious affairs and Israel's moral norms and Israel's social order and Israel's foreign relations entirely as he saw fit. That was unacceptable, because Israelite kings weren't autonomous, absolute powers. They were subordinates. They ruled under gods. And their rule, therefore, their reign, had to be determined, not by their own desires, not by their own whims, but by the law of God. Hence the necessity in verses 18 and 19 of them immersing themselves in that law. So self-indulgence, self-determination. Third abuse, self-importance. A king making too much of his royal position, confusing authority with superiority, acting as though his subjects are lesser human beings, somehow beneath him in dignity. That too was unacceptable. And all such haughtiness then is explicitly ruled out in verse 20. He must not consider himself better than his brothers. So those were the three abuses then. Self-indulgence, self-determination, self-importance. The three potential abuses of monarchy about which Moses here is so concerned. And we need to realize that he isn't scaremongering here. He isn't being over the top. He isn't talking about very remote, worst case scenarios. The subsequent history of Israel emphatically vindicates Moses' concerns here. Think of King Solomon. When it came to women, Solomon's self-indulgence knew virtually no bounds. He had 700 wives and 300 concubines. Think of King Jeroboam, about whom we read earlier on. There in that passage, his northern tribes, as I explained briefly, his northern tribes have just broken away from King Rehoboam's southern tribe of Judah. And Jeroboam realizes that while the majority of the population are with him, there's something he doesn't have. There's something that Rehoboam has back in Judah. Rehoboam still has the Jerusalem temple. And he reasons with himself then, if these people go up to offer sacrifices at the temple of the Lord in Jerusalem, they will again give their allegiance to Rehoboam, king of Judah. He's worried about this, and so what does he do? He has two golden calves constructed. He places one in Bethel, he places the other in Dan. Here are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt. Now, from a political perspective, it's brilliant. It's absolute genius. But of course, it's pure self-determination, showing utter contempt for the law of God. I think of King Rehoboam, about whom we also read earlier. And he then has just ascended the throne of Israel. And the people have come to him and they're wanting to know what sort of king he's going to be. They want to know whether he's going to be harsh and oppressive like his father Solomon, or whether he's going to lighten their load for them. And you remember then the counsel that his older, more senior advisors give him. If today you will be a servant to these people and serve them, they will always be your servants. But we read in the next verse, Rehoboam rejected the advice the elders gave him. He couldn't countenance being a servant king. He couldn't countenance serving his subjects. That was beneath him. He deserved more respect than that, because there was a deep-seated self-importance about this man. And still today, of course, much of what purports to be leadership is marred and invalidated by these three abuses: self-indulgence, self-determination, and self-importance. And I think that that presents us then with at least two challenges. First of all, if you are in leadership this morning, in some capacity, whether in the church as an elder, or whether in the workplace as a boss, wherever it might be, you need to beware these pitfalls that Moses is highlighting all these centuries ago. You need to cultivate self-discipline in the place of self-indulgence. You need to cultivate submission to God in the place of self-determination. You need to cultivate concern for others in the place of self-importance. Make sure that you don't fall into these traps that Moses is highlighting for us. And then the second challenge is this: whether you are in any kind of leadership or not, pray for leaders. Pray for bosses at work. Pray for local and national rulers. Pray for office bearers in the Church of Jesus Christ. Pray for leadership that is good and wholesome and healthy. Pray for leadership which is free from these kinds of abuses. Abraham Lincoln once said this. He said, "Nearly all men can stand adversity, but if you want to test a man's character, give him power." There's an abiding relevance, isn't there, about the warnings which Moses gives us in these verses in Deuteronomy 17. So that's the first thing this morning: kingship in Israel. Secondly this morning, priesthood in Israel. Priesthood in Israel. And this then is chapter 18, verses 1 to 8. And I think once again, we need at the outset here to recognize that these verses are limited in their scope. Once again, Moses is not giving us here a job description. The focus is very narrow and very specific. It's the priests' living arrangements with which Moses here is concerned. And so on the one hand then, he insists, doesn't he, that the Levites, that is the priestly tribe, the Levites aren't to have an inheritance in the land of Canaan. That's what is being said in verses 1 and 2. So you would be able then in future years to visit a region of Israel called Judah. And you'd be able to visit a region of Israel called Ephraim. But you wouldn't be able to visit a region of Israel called Levi, because the Levites weren't to have any inheritance in the land of Canaan. Moses, on the one hand, is insistent on that. But then on the other hand, he's equally insistent that the Levites' lack of land, their lack of fields, their lack of crops, their lack of the means of subsistence was to be compensated by the other Israelites. The other Israelites were to support them materially and financially. They were to supply their needs. So verse 4, "You are to give them the first fruits of your grain, new wine and oil, and the first wool from the shearing of your sheep, for the Lord your God has chosen them and their descendants out of all your tribes to stand and minister in the Lord's name always. And then verses 6 to 8 just really applies that principle to one kind of specific situation. But all of this raises a question, doesn't it? Why weren't the Levites to have an inheritance in the land of Canaan, when all the other tribes were going to have an allocated portion of real estate? How come the Levites were going to be treated differently? Well, the answer is given, isn't it, in verse 2. And that statement then, in the middle of that verse, the Lord is their inheritance. The Levites were to have no physical, material inheritance in Canaan because God was to be their inheritance. And it seems to me that in order to fully understand what's going on here, we need to bear in mind a later passage in the Old Testament in which this same kind of language resurfaces. So I'm talking then about Psalm 16. Psalm 16 is a psalm of David. And in that psalm, David, in language that echoes Deuteronomy 18, David describes God as his inheritance. At the beginning of that psalm, he has said, "You are my Lord. Apart from you, I have no good thing." At the end of that psalm, he looks forward to an eternity in the presence of God, joy in your presence. And in the middle of that psalm, in verses 5 and 6 of Psalm 16, he says this, "Lord, you have assigned me my portion and my cup. You have made my lot secure. The boundary lines have fallen for me in pleasant places. Surely I have a delightful inheritance." And he's very evocatively here using the kind of language that might well be applied to a physical inheritance in Canaan. He talks about boundary lines and pleasant places. But he's talking about God as his inheritance. As Derek Kidner puts it in his commentary, David is saying the most favoured tribe at the allotment of boundaries could boast nothing as goodly as this. God is David's inheritance. But there's something strange about that, isn't there? The strange thing about that is this: David isn't a Levite. David isn't of that tribe. David is of the tribe of Judah. David is of a tribe that does indeed have a real physical inheritance in the land of Canaan. And yet here we have David, this non-Levite, echoing the words of Deuteronomy 18:2 and saying that God, not some place in Canaan, God is his inheritance. And it seems to me that, as I said a moment ago, this helps us understand what's going on here in Deuteronomy 18. We've said before in this series that the whole Old Testament period, the whole Old Testament age, is an age of pictures. An age in which God, the supreme teacher in the universe, is teaching his people Israel in very graphic and very earthy ways, through animal sacrifices and community stonings and temple buildings and those kinds of means. It's all very tangible, it's all very vivid, it's all very arresting. And I think you see that the Levites' disinheritance falls into that category. I think here God is teaching all of the Israelites, not just the Levites, he's teaching all of the Israelites, that look, I am your inheritance. And it doesn't really matter at the end of the day which tribe you're from. You may be from a very affluent tribe that has a wonderful geographical inheritance. You may have fields that are full of crops. You may have wonderful forests and orchards and olive groves. You may have plenty of milk and honey in your particular area. You may have comfortable houses that you dwell in. You may be a very affluent tribe. But the reality is that I am your supreme possession. I am your true treasure. I am your all. And if you're ever tempted to forget that, if you ever find yourselves becoming a bit too attached to your Canaan inheritance, to your geographical inheritance, to your physical possessions, then just look at the Levites. Just look at that tribe, who are born with nothing and who die with nothing. And they stand for all of you. They are where you're all at in reality. They are a visual aid in your midst, powerfully illustrating what it means to be the people of God. Because being the people of God ultimately means that your inheritance isn't this worldly. Your inheritance is me. I am your supreme possession. And I'm saying then that David understood this. David understood that the Levites had a symbolic, theological significance. And that's how then he could apply the language of Deuteronomy 18 to himself. In a sense, he was a Levite because God was his inheritance. And all of us today, as God's people, in a sense, we are Levites. However rich we are in this world's terms, whatever bank balance, whatever capital, whatever assets, whatever salary, we have God as our supreme possession. We were born with nothing, we shall die with nothing really. But we have God. He is our treasure. He is our all. And if this morning you're forgetting that, if this morning you know in your heart of hearts, perhaps you wouldn't admit it to anybody, but you know in your heart of hearts you're becoming somewhat attached, somewhat shackled to this worldly things, look at the Levites, these people who had no inheritance, and see yourself as a Levite this morning. They stood for you. They pictured you. That's where you are this morning. God is your inheritance. And what an infinitely greater inheritance. All our this worldly possessions will fade. They spoil. They lose their luster. They eventually fail to satisfy. But this God of infinite beauty and infinite majesty, this God who is so enthralling and fascinating, what a vastly greater inheritance. Let's this morning come back to this, that he is our treasure, he is our all. So we've seen then kingship in Israel, we've seen priesthood in Israel, but then thirdly and finally, prophecy in Israel. Prophecy in Israel. And this then is chapter 18, verses 9 to 22. And you'll notice then that this section starts on a very austere note, that list in verses 10 to 12 of all these different practices which were so common in the surrounding nations and indeed amongst the peoples who lived in Canaan before the Israelites did. And I think we need to appreciate then what kind of practices these are. They are all then means of some kind of supernatural communication, or they're almost all means of some kind of supernatural communication. They are means then by which the pagans made contact with unearthly spiritual powers. And I think we should be very careful about dismissing this list as belonging to very primitive cultures. I think, in fact, that many of these practices are very much alive and well today, and indeed alive and well, and perhaps increasingly so, within our own Western society. If anything, there's been a resurgence, has there not, of these kinds of practices within our culture over the past few decades. And so it's against that very dark backdrop, you see, that Moses then, in verses 15 and onwards, presents the Israelites with prophecy. He explains to them what prophecy is. And you see, the light, the bright light of that shines even more brightly against this dark and shady background that he's given us there in those verses. And Moses then is wanting to contrast Israel's means of supernatural communication, Israel's means of being in contact with this unseen spiritual world. He's wanting to contrast their prophecy with these pagan practices. And he brings out then three distinct attributes of Israelite prophecy. First of all, he says, your prophets are safe. Your prophets are safe. You see, I said a moment ago that most of those practices mentioned in verses 10 to 12 are means of supernatural communication. Perhaps the one notable exception is the first one, there in verse 10, "Let no one be found among you who sacrifices his son or daughter in the fire." Now, that wasn't a revelatory kind of practice. The purpose of that wasn't to receive revelation from the gods. The purpose of that was to express devotion and to offer a sacrifice. But I think the reason Moses puts it there is in order to set a certain tone, which is this: these practices I am listing here are dangerous. They are of the same kind of order as sacrificing your child in the fire. They may not seem as overtly dangerous and sinister as that, but they are of the same order. They too, in a metaphorical sense, are playing with fire. And you see, it's against that backdrop then that he presents Israelite prophecy. And he gives the background, doesn't he, to Israelite prophecy. He says in verse 16, "For this is what you asked of the Lord your God at Horeb on the day of the assembly, when you said, 'Let us not hear the voice of the Lord our God, nor this great fire any more, or we will die.' And so I gave you prophets," God is saying. Do you see the contrast then? That in these pagan revelatory practices, that there's real danger. It's a murky business. It's a dangerous, sinister thing. And yet here's Israelite prophecy, and the very purpose of it was so that the Israelites would be safe and wouldn't be consumed by God's fire there on Mount Sinai. And still today, it's the wonder of Christian biblical religion, isn't it? That it's safe. We have this Bible, and God speaks to us here in a way that we can safely receive and safely take in and safely digest. Still today, in many of these other practices that are out there, there's real danger, I think. There's an account in Evangelicals Now last month, which some of you may have read, a man giving his testimony. And this man claims to then have been in the grip of some form of demon possession before he became a Christian. And he talks about an instance then not long before his conversion when he found himself, as I say, as he puts it, in the grip of this demon possession. He'd certainly been involved in the occult and that kind of movement. He found himself on a train track with a train coming toward him. He managed to avoid that, but he was pointing to the sheer dangerousness of this world in which he had got himself caught up. Now, I don't know what you all make of that, but I think there's no doubt whatsoever that these occult practices are real. There's real dangers involved in them. And to dismiss that isn't a sign of being all reformed and mature. I think it's a sign, actually, of being influenced by Richard Dawkins' brand of materialistic naturalism, that there's no spiritual world out there. There is a spiritual world out there, and it's dangerous. And what a wonderful, beautiful, contrasting safety in Christian biblical religion, this book in which God speaks to us, and we're not consumed. So your prophets are safe, Moses says. Secondly, your prophets, he says, are unsolicited. Your prophets are unsolicited. Because that then was a mark of these pagan practices, that it was the worshippers who were coming to the gods wanting to find things out, wanting information. The worshippers were taking the initiative. They were engaging in these practices in order to receive information. In prophecy, it's very different, Moses says. Look at verse 17. "The Lord said to me, 'What they say is good. I will raise up for them a prophet like you from among their brothers. I will put my words in his mouth.'" The initiative is with God. He's revealing on his terms to his people. And I think, again, that's an important characteristic of authentic Christianity, isn't it? That God has revealed to us on his terms. And that may seem a very obvious point, but I get concerned sometimes by the kind of language that we use as evangelicals. When we talk, for instance, about how I'm seeking God's will on something, I'm seeking God's will on whether I should move to this place, or whether I should take that job, or whether I should marry this person. And I think we need to come back to our great Reformed doctrine of the sufficiency of Scripture. God has told us His will. His will is that we love the Lord our God with all our heart, mind, soul and strength, and our neighbours ourselves. His will is what's expressed in this book, the Bible. And as for whether we should move to that place or go for that job, He's not going to tell us that. He's not going to give some thunderbolt from the sky. He's not going to suddenly give us that information. We must take that decision for ourselves on good, sound principles in a responsible and mature manner. But God isn't going to tell us that. He has told us everything that we need to know. And I think that it can be almost bordering on what Moses is talking about here when we become obsessed with seeking His will for all these different details in our lives. And then the third distinct attribute is this. Moses says, your prophets are Moses-like. Your prophets are Moses-like. That's emphasized, isn't it? A couple of times. In verse 15, the Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me. And then again in verse 18, a prophet like you, that is like Moses. What does that mean? In what sense were Israel's prophets going to be like Moses? Well, I don't think it can be talking about their role, that these subsequent prophets were going to have the same role as Moses. Because Moses, of course, had a unique role. Moses ushered in this whole new epoch of revelation there on Mount Sinai, this epoch which would last for centuries, right up until the coming of the Messiah. And none of the other prophets, not Isaiah, not Jeremiah, not Daniel, none of the other prophets were going to have that kind of role. So I don't think he's talking about role. I think he's talking about character. He's saying subsequent prophets who are true, who are genuine, will have a character that is like mine, will be ethically and morally on the same page, on the same wavelength. And that's important then, because you'll notice that at the end of this chapter, Moses gives a test, doesn't he, about distinguishing true prophets from false prophets. And he says then that this is how you'll know a prophet is false, when he prophesies something and it doesn't happen. And that's all well and good, isn't it? But that test, of course, only takes you so far. Because what about when a prophet prophesies something and it does happen? Does that mean he's definitely a true prophet? Well, no, it doesn't. We've seen back in chapter 13 and verse 1 that false prophets can prophesy something's going to happen, and it does happen. But they're still false prophets. They're still not genuine men who have been sent by God. And that's why I think, really, the true test is the one that Moses is given here. Look, this is how you'll know a proper prophet who has been sent by God. He'll be like me in his character. He won't be an immoral man. He won't be a drunkard. He won't be an idolater. He won't be a man who lives carelessly. He will be a man who lives the kind of life that I've lived. Of course, not a perfect life, but a life with a moral tenor to it. A life that's patterned after the law of God. That's how you'll know true prophets will be like me in their ethical character. And again, I think that's an important principle for us today, isn't it? That every servant of God that we encounter, we should judge them, we should assess them on the basis of character primarily. Not primarily gift. Not primarily charisma. Not primarily their abilities in ministry. Because men can have those and yet emphatically not be servants of the living God. We need to primarily look for character. That's what attests those who are truly God's servants. You remember Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount talking about those who on the last day will say, Lord, Lord, did we not cast out demons and heal people in your name? And Jesus doesn't argue with them, doesn't say, no, you didn't. They had done those things. They had performed miracles. They had performed spectacular phenomena. But he says, I never knew you. They weren't his people. Their characters would have shown that. And so, prophecy in Israel then, so different from all these abhorrent Canaanite practices. Israelites' prophets were safe. Israelites' prophets were unsolicited. They were bringing revelation from God at his initiative. And Israel's prophets were Moses-like in their characters. But just as we close then, just to come back to where we began this morning. I said at the outset then that the authority figures we encounter in this passage are time-bound, culture-bound authority figures. They're authority figures which we don't particularly have in our society. We don't have monarchs in the sense of monarchy here. We don't have prophets. We don't have priests. But, of course, there's a sense in which, as God's people, actually we do. Or at least we have one person who is our king and our priest and our prophet. One person who fulfilled the terms of Deuteronomy 17 and 18 to a degree that nobody else ever did in Israel's history. We have the Lord Jesus. Jesus is our king, our priest, and our prophet. And as I say, he wonderfully fulfills the terms of this passage. As our king, he's free from all those abuses. There's no self-indulgence with him. He was the one who lived in this earth as a man with nowhere to lay his head. There's no self-determination with him. My food and drink, he said, is to do the will of my Father. He lived in complete submission to the law of God. There's no self-importance with him. He stooped down and washed the filthy feet of his disciples. He went to a cross and died between two criminals. He's our king. He's our priest. And of course, he's our priest with a difference, our priest with a twist. This priest, unlike any other priest in history, wasn't just a priest. He wasn't a priest who carried someone else's blood, an animal's blood, into the presence of God. He was a priest who was also the sacrifice, also the victim. He carried his own blood into the presence of God. So that, in a very poignant twist on this passage here, there at Calvary, when he was supremely doing his priestly work, God wasn't his inheritance. God left him. God forsook him. God was nowhere to be seen. God slammed the doors of heaven shut on that priest on that day. He was bearing the punishment for our sin, offering a sacrifice that would reconcile us to God with no further sacrifices ever required. He's our priest. And then thirdly, he's our prophet. And he's our prophet then, and he's Moses-like in his character. In fact, he exceeds Moses in his character because he never fell. He never sinned. He never failed. He exceeds Moses vastly in his character. But he's Moses-like not just in his character, but in his role. Because just as Moses ushered in that new epoch of revelation, so Jesus then, when he came, ushered in a new epoch of revelation. He ushered in a new covenant to be marked by superior revelation to that old covenant. So that through this prophet, Jesus, we see God in the clearest possible sense. Anyone who has seen me has seen the Father, he says. Do you know this prophet, priest and king this morning? Do you know this king as your king? Do you know this priest as your priest who offered a sacrifice on your behalf? Do you know this prophet as your prophet through whom you have come to encounter and experience the living God? Isn't that what people are searching for everywhere? Isn't that why these practices are so resurgent in our society today? These pagan, abhorrent practices, because everyone is searching for what is out there, searching for truth, for ultimate reality. Where do you find it? You find it through this prophet, Jesus Christ. As we sang a few moments ago, it's in him that we see God. If you come to him, and if you come into a relationship with him, you will have the deepest experience and acquaintance with the most ultimate reality, the God of glory himself. Come to Jesus and know him in these ways. Amen.